everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to invite you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the economics and sustainability threat of dirty energy, the economics behind the oil-based energy, and its larger cost to society and the environment. I have four panelists, each sharing approximately 15 minutes. From Santa Rosa, California, Richard Heinberg. He'll be our first guest. Richard is widely regarded as one of the world's experts in peak oil, its repercussions on the world economy, food and transportation, and the need to transition away from fossil fuels to create a more sustainable future. He is currently the senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. He was featured in Leonardo DiCaprio's film, The 11th Hour, and frequently appears in the media to discuss fossil fuel as part of our culture and climate change. He is the author of over 10 books on oil depletion, energy economics, and climate change, and ecological issues, including The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. His most recent publication is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. His websites are richardheinberg.com and postcarbon.org. He will be followed by Kurt Cobb from Oregon. Kurt is an author. He is a columnist who speaks and writes frequently on peak oil, energy, and the environment. He is a regular contributor to the Christian Science Monitor and has written for other publications around the world, including being featured in the Oil Drum, oilprice.com, Peak Oil Review, and Common Dreams La Mode. He is a graduate of Stanford University, and he also will be discussing this in depth, and we'll be going to him as our second panelist. We have other panelists as well. We will be going to those, and I'll introduce them as we get a little further into the program. But we'll start with our first two and say hello right now to our first panelist, who is standing by in Santa Rosa, California, Richard Heinberg. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Gary.
Thank you. Please provide an overview of the economics behind the start of oil extraction from the earth or oceans to its final source of consumption, and how much does both this nation and the world at a large depend upon oil for its energy needs at this moment?
Right. Well, oil was the economic miracle of the 20th century. We had never had an energy source quite like it. It's concentrated, it's portable, it's the perfect transportation fuel. And when we first started getting the stuff out of the ground, it was incredibly cheap. It cost very, very little to go out and explore for oil and drill holes in the ground compared to the wealth in both energy and money that would flow up out of oil wells if they were successfully drilled. And so cheap, abundant oil really should be thought of as the power of the 20th century. Now, we've become enormously dependent on oil during the course of the last few decades, and we use it not only for transportation, automobiles, ships, trains, planes, trucks, and all the rest, but we also use it in a variety of industrial processes as a feedstock for chemicals and pharmaceuticals. We use it in so many ways it's hard to count, in paints, in lubricants, and so on. It's hard to imagine modern life without oil. And so when the price of oil goes up, it tends to raise the price of lots of other things, and most noticeably food, because we've created a food system that is overwhelmingly oil-dependent. We use food for tractors. We use food to transport inputs to the farm from elsewhere and then outputs from the farm ultimately to the consumer's plate. So when you take account of all of those energy inputs to agriculture and the food system as a whole, turns out we're spending about 7 calories of energy to put 1 calorie of food on the plate. So our food system is very, very dependent on oil. And then transportation, I already mentioned transportation, but it's important to understand how central transportation is to the economy. Again, transportation, almost 100% dependent on oil, is at the heart of trade. You know, what would happen to global trade or even local trade, our ability to get to the store, our ability for the store to restock its shelves, if we didn't have cheap oil, if suddenly, for some reason, the oil tanks went dry, then in effect, the entire global economy would simply shut down. Now, nobody's expecting that to happen, apart from some kind of cataclysmic war in the Middle East or something like that. We're not facing a sudden shutdown in global oil supplies. But the reality is this is a depleting non-renewable resource. And if you look at the trends, the fundamental trends we're facing right now are two. First, we're seeing diminishing returns, both energy and financial returns from exploration and production of oil. And at the same time, we're seeing increasing environmental costs and risks from the production of oil. And both of these trends are being driven simply by the low-hanging fruit phenomenon. Again, it's not as though we're about to get the last oil out of the ground. We're not running out of oil, but we've extracted oil using the low-hanging fruit principle. So we got the easiest and best oil in the early 20th century, the mid-20th century, and since the 1970s, we've been going after more and more difficult oil, and this is especially true just in the last decade. So more and more of total global oil supplies are coming from unconventional sources like the Canadian tar sands, like tight oil that's produced by fracking and horizontal drilling, from deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico and other locations around the world. And all of these unconventional sources require more upfront investment. They usually decline much faster in production, with the exception of the tar sands. And all of them entail much higher environmental costs and risks. So that's where we are right now.
I appreciate that insight. I want you to expand a little further, if you would, please, on this, Richard. And because when oil does finally reach its peak, although some say it has already, what is the future scenario for access? You mentioned the low-hanging fruit was easy. That means that they're going to have to go to extremes. And when you put yourself into an extreme position, you can never control the outcome. There's no mathematical model of probability. If you start digging, let's say, 10,000 feet into the ocean, imagine the mess we had with a relatively minor accident compared to one that could be major, where you have an earthquake and you cannot seal it, and hence forever unlimited amounts of oil come through that earthquake fault, which is entirely possible. Or you're in, let's say, the Arctic. You may even be close to shore. You may be in shallow water because the Arctic is relatively shallow, many places 500 feet from the surface to the ground. But let's say that there's an unusual weather event and it starts to freeze. There's no oil rig that could withstand what would happen with ice around it and icebergs and ice flow. It would just crush it. And yet they're already contemplating this. They're already fighting for positioning, looking at the money to invest, the money to return, the position and marketability, but not the consequences if this goes bad. Could you explain that to us as well?
Sure. Well, since 2005, regular conventional oil production globally has been flat to declining. There's been a little bit of increasing crude oil production overall, all of that is as a result of increasing production in the U.S. from the Bakken Formation in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford Formation in Texas, and that's all being produced by horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing. This is known as tight oil in the industry. And, of course, hydrofracturing entails increasing environmental risks. Shipping tight oil from the Bakken has been the cause of train wrecks and explosions that have decimated several communities. So these environmental risks are very real. You mentioned the Arctic conditions. Shell has put an end to most of its exploration in the Arctic simply because they see the financial costs, let alone the environmental risks, as being too great. In fact, for the industry as a whole, there's a tendency now to pull back on investment in upstream oil production at a time when the requirement for investment is exploding through the roof. The need for investment has doubled over the past decade in the oil industry. And for the most part, the industry has been able to come up with that those investment dollars, partly because of extremely low interest rates. But now they're getting to the point where many of the oil companies are actually cutting back on investment simply because there are no good places left to invest in that don't require higher oil prices. Now, we're at very high oil prices right now compared to past history, over $100 a barrel for the last 3-4 years in terms of global oil prices. And yet, even with prices where they are now, it's not enough to incentivize further investment in upstream exploration and production for many of the companies. So this is a clear indication of diminishing returns, both energy returns and financial returns. And at the same time, of course, we are seeing these incidents like the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and then, of course, the Canadian tar sands, which from an environmental point of view is just a disaster in slow motion. It never stops. It's a planned disaster. If you look at the landscape around Fort McMurray where the production is happening in Alberta, it's just a moonscape. And of course the climate impacts from tar sands are much greater than those for regular conventional oil, because the tar that's dug out of the ground has to be processed, and that processing uses a great deal of energy. And, of course, that burning that energy creates even more carbon emissions than will be created by burning the finished fuel from the refining process. So we're on this treadmill to increasing oil costs, increasing oil prices, and increasing oil risks. And fundamentally, society has been warned. A number of us have been talking about this for years, and yet we have no plan B. There is no coordinated effort on the part of industry and government to transition away from oil in the time that we have left before this whole problem gets really, really serious.
Richard, my final thought I'd like for you to respond to is that if you could compare the direct and indirect cost factors between oil refining and clean alternatives, that would strengthen the argument that much more funding and resources need to be put in developing, utilizing renewable energy sources and technologies more rapidly in order to decrease our reliance upon oil.
Right. Well, every energy source entails environmental risks. It's true that sunlight and wind are free and abundant, and there's no environmental risk to the fundamental source. But the technology that we use to capture sunlight and wind energy does come with environmental risks and costs. We have to manufacture solar panels and wind turbines and transport them. And right now, most of that manufacturing and transportation is done with oil. But at the end of the day, if you look at the full life cycle analysis of the environmental risks and costs per unit of energy produced, it's clear that renewable energy sources are cleaner. And if we're going to have a sustainable energy economy, it's going to have to come from renewable sources, simply because the non-renewable sources of energy, the fossil fuels, are getting more difficult and expensive and costly with every passing year. We only have a short period of time in which we'll be able to afford making this energy transition. Before the declining or diminishing returns from the economic production of fossil fuels drives our economy into a place where we simply won't be able to afford to make that kind of investment. So we have to seize the moment and make that energy transition happen as quickly and as soon as possible. Really, literally, not only the climate, but the fate of industrial civilization really depend upon this effort. It's the most important thing happening or needing to happen in the world today.
Well, we have to insist upon it. We can't ask our politicians. We have to have a Marshall Plan on clean economy, the clean part of energy. Richard Heimberg, thank you. Stay online. Richard is a fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. Let's now say hello to Kurt Cobb. Nice to have you with us today, Kurt.
Thanks for asking me back, Gary.
Kurt, I would like to have you begin by providing an overview of the economics behind the entire process of gas hydrofracking and every aspect, processing, drilling, shipping, and piping it to its final source of consumption. And here's why. Because we were led to believe that it's going to be very inexpensive, and it's completely safe, and it's cleaner than anything else, coal and, for example, and oil. Then I started doing some investigation and found out, indeed, for the first people into these financial syndicates, generally people who are heavy bettors, and are always ahead of the curve when it comes to getting in, making their money, and getting it out. They were putting millions of dollars into these syndicates to buy the rights to be able to go in and pay someone for their mineral rights and then exploit it. What no one told them was that the real money is made not from selling all this gas at a high price, but generally from the people got into these bubbles, created the bubbles, and when enough people get into a bubble, then the smart people get out, everyone else gets smashed, including the consumer whose home may be ruined, their water ruined. And I'd like for you to give us that part of this economic a reality check, because I don't see that this whole gas hydrofracking can be sustained. I think it's an enormous bubble. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with you that it can't be sustained very much longer. And part of the problem is that the decline rates on these wells are so high. They're somewhere between 79 and 95% lower production rates after 3 years. And we know this just by looking at the well data. It's not a forecast, it's a fact. And I think that people who got into this didn't understand that they were, one, they're dealing with a depleting asset, but that it's a depleting asset that depletes very, very quickly. Conventional natural gas wells that aren't sunk, 10,000 feet down, they're maybe a few hundred feet, maybe 1,000 feet, they may decline 3 or 4 or 5% per year. That's what we were used to. And suddenly we're into this brand new kind of gas that wasn't accessible to us before, but that takes a lot more energy and money to get out of the ground. And I think the industry advertised to investors and to the public that it was going to be easy and cheap to get that gas. And we know now that it's not. And in fact, most of the people who got in at the end, including some major oil companies who made major investments in the shale gas area, have found out that it's not profitable at these prices. So you have, what you've got is a system that attracts capital to create a glut of gas, which is clearly what we have now, that sells at low prices, but it's high-priced gas. It's gas that costs a lot more, or it costs significantly more in many cases than they're getting in the marketplace. So that has been the sort of strange economics of shale gas. People thought it was going to be cheap, got into it, thought that they were going to make money at those cheap prices. But I'm fond of the work of Art Berman, who's a petroleum consultant and who has published a number of things, public studies on these on shale gas. And he says that shale gas and shale oil, for that matter, it's not a renaissance, it's a retirement party. We wouldn't be going after these resources if we hadn't run out of the easy-to-get stuff. And I know that your previous guest, Richard Heinberg, talked about that whole issue. Same issue applies to natural gas. We've gotten the easy stuff out of the ground. Now we're going after the harder stuff, the stuff that's harder to get out of the ground, the stuff that's deeper. And we have to do this hydrofracking. And it's a new kind of hydrofracking. And here we need to talk about what that means for the environmental effects. Because what the industry contends is that this hydraulic fracturing has been going on since the late 40s. And so this is no different. This is just a little updated version. Well, it's a significantly different version, and it has a specific name. It's called high-volume slickwater hydraulic fracturing. That's what we're doing now. We used to use maybe hundreds of thousands of gallons to what they call frack or fracture a traditional well, a vertical well. Now we're using millions and millions of gallons of fracking fluid that's made slick with certain chemicals and has other chemicals in it, in order to open fractures in these very difficult-to-get shale formations. And some of that fluid, as you know, comes back to the surface, and it has to be disposed of. And I think one of the major dangers that people aren't aware of is that this fracking fluid, which comes back up, which is, they call it produced water, it actually is just regurgitating the water that was put down there to do the fracking, was originally going to municipal sewage plants until the municipal sewage people said, wait a minute, this stuff has radiation. It's natural radiation from these deep formations, but they said, we don't know how to handle that. So now this fluid is going to injection wells, an increasing number of injection wells. These are wells that are specifically designed to take this fluid and put it deep into the earth. And the idea here, we've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of these wells drilled in the United States over the last several decades to put chemical wastes in. And the idea was, well, if it's 9 or 10,000 feet down, it isn't going to hurt us. It's going to be inert way down there. And we're finding out that, in fact, some of that stuff is migrating back toward water tables. It's getting up through the drill hole, that these wells are not well maintained. So I think that's one of the immediate dangers. Of course, there are longer-term dangers. There are short-term dangers to people who are near the drilling site, air pollution, water pollution, the noise, the industrialization of the rural landscape is quite something to behold. But there's a longer-term problem that I think we don't think about because it's really long-term. I asked an environmental consultant to oil and gas industry. I said, what happens to these well casings, not 10 years, not 50 years, but 500 years from now? And he said, "Oh, they'll be gone. They'll disappear." And so those wells that we've drilled are going to have free-flowing fluids going back and forth in them. And so people who come after us, who live after us, are going to have real trouble with their groundwater. So I think that's, you know, from the environmental standpoint, those are the major concerns that I have. And I'll stop there and let you continue.
Thanks. I appreciate that in-depth comment, Kurt. When you look at the costs associated with our current rate of exploration and drilling for natural gas, and the promises our government states about the bright future of natural gas in the U.S., and then you look at the larger associated cost to human and ecological health, and the impact of fracking upon the environment, and the natural gas's contribution to climate change and global warming, then how sustainable is our reliance upon fracked natural gas at this time? And keep in mind that just today I read a report on the program that a group of individuals in Pennsylvania who worked in the Department of Health were told in the environmental section not to answer people's questions if they talked about gas hydrofracking, if they had health problems or water quality problems, because they knew it existed, but they were told, don't answer them. So there was a cover-up. there was word came from their bosses, don't mention any of this. So clearly the state officials have known and the companies have known and the federal government would have known that there were problems, yet none of this was discussed openly and honestly with the citizens of a community at these town meetings, nor with the individual purchasers of their mineral rights. Once given, they can't do anything about it. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the answers, of course, to those questions are upsetting, and maybe the state is concerned that they're going to cause people to file lawsuits or complain about the companies that they've already allowed to do this drilling, that somehow the state will get enmeshed in this in a legal battle. That's typical when you're faced with those kind of liabilities to just clam up. But it doesn't do anything for public health or to guide us on how to make the exploitation of natural gas safer. And let me say this, could we make the extraction of shale gas absolutely safe? I think the answer is no. But could we make it a lot safer? Sure, we could. But it would cost more money. It would make it more expensive to get it out of the ground. We'd have to handle the waste more carefully. We'd have to change the way in which we do the drilling. We'd have to be careful about catching all these fugitive emissions that come out of the well, these methane leaks, essentially. And that would cost us a lot of money. And the promise here was that, as you said, it would be cheap. Well, it's actually not going to be as cheap as we thought it was. And I think you would you like me to talk a little bit about the costs and the future
Yes.
the prices? Okay. Well, we're coming from an environment in the 1990s when natural gas was, on average, $1.92 per 1,000 cubic feet. Right now, natural gas is trading at about $4.50 a 1,000 cubic feet in the United States. That's about 125% higher than what we've been used to recently. And as it turns out, even that's not high enough for a number of wells, a large number of them. And the work that Art Berman, again, I mention him because he's one of the few people who've been absolutely honest about what the numbers say. And these are numbers provided by the industry, and they tell us that, in general, in order to get to profitability on shale gas, we're going to need to be above $6 a 1,000 cubic feet. Well, that's 200% higher than what we've been used to in the 1990s. And I do think that at that point and above, that investors can start making money. But it's certainly not the cheap energy that we were promised. But it's also an indication of how much more difficult and costly it is to get this out of the ground. Now, we've been told that this natural gas production in the United States is just going to continue to rise and rise and rise and rise for the next 30 or 40 years. As it turns out, natural gas production in the United States, the increases, now it's still been increasing, but the increases have been declining. So we had a 6.8% increase in production in 2010. Oh, I'm sorry, let me go to, those are world numbers, but we had a 7.4% increase in 2011, a 5.3% increase in 2012, and just a 1.2% increase in 2013. The growth rates in U.S. natural gas production are slowing. Could we ramp it up if prices are higher? Yes, I think we could. But that tells you that there's going to be a trade-off between the growth rate and the price. So I think we're going to pay substantially more for the gas that we get, and we're going to find out that natural gas isn't going to grow as much as quickly as we would like it to. And that means all the things that we were planning to do with natural gas. We're going to shut down our coal-fired power plants and just have natural gas-fired power plants, and that's going to make things cleaner. We're going to revitalize U.S. chemical industry with natural gas, cheap natural gas inputs. That's going to be harder to do. And we say, well, we're going to export some of this gas, too. Well, that's going to be hard to do if the growth rates continue to sputter as they are now. And it's going to be hard to do if natural gas in the United States goes above $6, makes us non-competitive to export to Europe. The only place we could export then is to Japan, which I think we might do, but I just don't think there's going to be enough gas to do all the things that we say we want to do. I think there's going to be more, just not as much and not as cheap as we thought.
My final question for you is, can you compare the direct and indirect cost factors between natural gas and clean alternatives that would strengthen the argument that much more funding and resources need to be put into natural resources?
Well, I think that it's clear that U.S. government policy favors the production of fossil fuels, including natural gas, and there are a number of subsidies, some of them hidden, some of them right out in the open. If we put that kind of emphasis on renewables, I think we'd be a lot further. I think that one thing that's going to drive renewables is the tremendous changes in advances in technology. And we hear about the changes in technology, advances in technology in the oil and gas industry, but they're not nearly as profound as what's happening in solar, for example. And I think if we decided that what we're going to do is pay the true cost of natural gas, the true cost of oil, the true cost of coal, that is, including all of these side effects, we are going to try to contain them, we'd be paying a much higher price, and we didn't subsidize them, we'd be paying a much higher price for our fossil fuels, and that would actually allow renewable energy to become much more competitive. So I think that, you know, that's something for us to consider in terms of policy. I'm not sure it's anything that this Congress or this president is going to advocate, but I'm a little bit hopeful that we may put more emphasis on renewable energy at the government level. And I'm very hopeful about the developments in technology, and so I think we've got a bright future in that regard.
Yeah, you're listening to Kurt Cobb from Oregon. His website is resourceinsights.blogspot.com. And now let's go over and say hello to my final two panelists. From Tacoma Park, Maryland, is Kevin Camps. He is a specialist in radioactive waste storage and nuclear facility operations for Beyond Nuclear, a nonprofit organization opposed to nuclear power and weapons and advocating for safeguarding our future. And for years, he was a leader opposing the nuclear industry's efforts to dump radioactive waste at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, and to challenge federal subsidies for new reactors and nuclear waste projects. He traveled to Chernobyl, which resulted in his founding a chapter of the International Chernobyl Children's Project, and his website is beyondnuclear.org. And from Boulder, Colorado, Dr. Zane Selvins is a planetary geophysicist turned energy and climate policy wonk. He is currently the Director of Research and Policy at Clean Energy Action, a nonprofit based in Boulder, Colorado, where he focuses on coal supply issues, carbon, and risk pricing in renewable energy alternatives. And he has especially been active in decarbonizing the city of Boulder's electricity supply. He has a doctorate in geophysics, University of Colorado, and has worked as a university laboratory atmospheric and space physicist and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And his website is Zane, Z-A-N-E, Selvins, S-E-A-L-V-A-N-S. We'll start with Kevin. Nice to have you with us, Kevin.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, unlike some of the other dirty energy sources the U.S. relies upon heavily, such as oil, natural gas, and coal, there's at least in the United States a strong movement to discontinue nuclear energy. And although there are plans to build new nuclear reactor facilities, many of the old ones are coming offline. And we're witnessing more and more nuclear mishaps, and politicians are waking up, or being forced to at least, that nuclear might not be the way to go in the future. So I'd like you to begin, please, with first summarizing where the U.S. stands with respect to nuclear energy at this moment, and then give a general overview of the economics and costs associated with building and sustaining a nuclear reactor, and also the cost of waste storage, which would be indefinite and also come at high cost, especially when we're told that at one time back in the 1950s, nuclear would be too cheap to actually measure, to monitor. Start there then, please.
Right. Well, the status of nuclear power in the United States right now is that it is an industry in decline. So we still do have 100 operating reactors in the United States as we speak. But last year alone, there were 5 reactor closures in the United States, which was a record number. And that is due, as you mentioned, the economics. It's due to the fact that even operating and maintaining reactors that have paid off their mortgages, so to speak, actually the public paid off their mortgages years ago, they're still so expensive to run that they can't compete with fracked natural gas, and we're no friends of fracking by any means, but they also can't compete with the ever-expanding renewable energy sources in this country, wind power, especially, but solar PV is growing by leaps and bounds. So where the Bush-Cheney administration called for a nuclear renaissance in 2001, that really fell flat on its face, despite massive subsidies contained in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and where there were three dozen or more new reactor proposals across the country just 5 years ago. Most of those are either canceled or postponed or suspended, and only four of those new reactor proposals are moving ahead, two in South Carolina, two in Georgia. And the only way they're getting away with that is the companies involved are investing none of their own money. They have none of their own skin in the game. It's the public that's being gouged to build these four new reactors. So in both states, the ratepayers are being gouged on their electricity bills. It's illegal to do that in most states, but unfortunately, several states in the Southeast have made it legal to do that. So in South Carolina, for example, there have been more than a half dozen rate increases in the last few years. So groups like ARP are up in arms because their members will never see electricity from these reactors. They will probably pass away before these reactors are activated, if they ever are. Yet they're forced to pay on their monthly bills to build these plants. And the other massive subsidy that's pushing forward the bad idea in Georgia of two new reactors is $8.3 billion in federal loan guarantees, and actually the loans. So it's the federal taxpayers loaning the money, and if the project defaults and there's a greater than 50% risk that it will, then the federal taxpayers will eat that money. They will be left holding the bag. So a lot of folks have probably heard about the Solyndra Solar default in California, a federal loan guarantee that went belly up. That was $535 million. Well, Vogtle Units 3 and 4 nuclear power plant in Georgia, that's 15 times more money and at a much higher risk of default than Solyndra was, and Solyndra did default. So the industry has been making a killing in terms of making $1 million a day at each reactor in electricity sales while getting away with murder. That is externalizing its costs and risks and liabilities onto the public, onto ratepayers and taxpayers. And that's been the history of the industry going back to the 1950s.
When you look at the costs associated with operating our present nuclear reactors, and much of this cost to taxpayers, and the promises our government states about the right future of new generation nuclear reactors, and then you look at the larger costs associated with the impact of radiation upon human health and the environment, and then the fact that almost every single firm absolute statement they made has been shown to be incorrect, and that there has been leakage of radiation at every single nuclear power plant, and there have been health consequences. We did a survey where I went to every single house in Connecticut near one of the nuclear facilities, and one out of every three people on that street, the women had breast cancer who had no risk factors for breast cancer. And one of those women was Miss Merrill of Merrill Lynch, and she then is leading the cause to educate people, wake up, you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't smell it, and don't believe that radiation doesn't exist here. It does. We have all these breast cancers, and then we have those when the nuclear facility is closed, and we have examples of this, the rate of breast cancer within 50 miles around that nuclear facility drops statistically. So could you give us your input on the safety that we've been lied to about nuclear, and the fact that if there's an accident, they really have no plans, not in New York City? How are you going to vacate 20 million people within 50 miles of New York City? You couldn't. Wouldn't be possible.
Well, it's such a vital question you ask. When nuclear economics are discussed, often the health impacts are simply left out, which is incredible. I mean, my own involvement in anti-nuclear activism is highly motivated, not on the costs and dollars and cents of nuclear power, which is a very important issue. It's important to people where their money is going and being robbed from them by a filthy rich industry like the nuclear industry. But much more vital a question is the health impact of nuclear power. So even if there is not an accident, there are regular releases of radioactivity from operating nuclear power plants. In fact, from every stage of the uranium fuel chain, from mining to milling to processing to enrichment, to the reactors themselves, and then, of course, the forever deadly poison of high-level radioactive waste that we have no solution for after more than 50 years of generating it in the commercial industry. Every exposure to ionizing radioactivity carries a health risk for cancer. That's been affirmed by the National Academies of Science for decades. And so these companies are allowed, with a government permit, either from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the Environmental Protection Agency or state-level agencies, to discharge radioactivity into the air, to discharge it into the water. And then, of course, there are the accidents. So Fukushima Daiichi is a global catastrophe that continues to unfold on a daily basis. You've got Chernobyl, where some estimates put the number of deaths attributable as high as 1 million. The United Nations would say it's only 4,000. Well, even if it's only 4,000, I think it's much higher than that. That's 4,000 lives snuffed out before their time. And we've had major radioactivity releases here in the United States. A little-known incident out in Grants, New Mexico, just after Three Mile Island had a 50% meltdown. It was in July of 1979. A uranium tailings dam made of earth, it wasn't even a concrete dam, burst, and a very large quantity of liquid radioactive tailings flowed down this river system called the Rio Porco, the major drinking water supply and irrigation supply for the Navajo tribes people who lived there. So there are health impacts at every stage of the uranium fuel chain. Incredibly, it's not factored into the cost of nuclear power.
I appreciate those insights. And my last thought on this, and I think it's something we don't think about, Kevin, is that President Clinton was tight with the owner of a large nuclear facility, the largest in the United States, and President Obama. And Obama hired two people, David Axelrod, who worked for one of the largest nuclear facilities in PR, and also his chief of staff, Ron Emanuel. And the media never goes into where these people have been before, what their affiliations are, and how that might impact official policy, but it certainly has. So we should also consider how tightly connected these industries are. Let's go out to Boulder, Colorado, where Dr. Zane Selvins is standing by. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi there. Nice to be on the show.
What do you think about the idea that we were told repeatedly, clean coal, and all that movement towards clean coal? Well, I come from West Virginia and Appalachia, and I've seen an awful lot of strip mining. I've seen people with black lung. I'd like to know exactly how you can make coal clean and non-toxic to the environment or people. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, there are a few different things that have been connotated with those words, clean coal, over the years. In the Clean Air Act amendments, looking at sulfur and nitrogen emissions, that was kind of the previous generation of clean coal, which has been addressed by moving to lower sulfur coals like the coal that comes out of Wyoming and the Powder River Basin, and the emissions trading scheme around sulfur dioxide emissions that has really done a pretty good job of mitigating acid rain in the Northeast. But that doesn't get at either the production issues, which I think you alluded to, especially with mountaintop removal in Appalachia, or to the climate issues associated with coal, the CO2 emissions that are really, you know, kind of inescapably linked to burning coal for electricity generation. And there's been a lot of talk about doing sequestration of the CO2 emissions from big stationary sources like coal plants. But, you know, all indications are that that is really very unlikely to become cost effective or to scale up to, the scale of operations that would be required to make a meaningful impact on the carbon emissions associated with coal. You'd have to have an infrastructure, you know, pipelines transporting the CO2 and sequestration reservoirs that are several times larger than the entire global oil and natural gas industry.
Well,
so yeah, I think clean coal is a misnomer. And
okay, if we continue with our current rates of coal extraction and consumption, what are some of the scenarios you might predict about the state of climate change and global warming and its larger impact upon the quality of life of this country?
I mean, given that sequestration is so expensive and challenging to scale up to meaningful levels, I think continued reliance on coal as an electricity generation fuel is really just not compatible with taking meaningful action on climate change. So if we are to address climate change in a meaningful way, I think we really need to, in quite short order, shut down our existing generation fleet that relies on coal, and, you know, certainly avoid building any new coal-fired generation.
What is the current economic standing within the coal industry of the companies? Are they very profitable? Are they becoming less profitable? Just like as one of our guests was talking about, the cost of extracting gas would have to be above $6 in order for it to be profitable, and that's not likely to happen in the near future, but the cost of getting it to where you could charge that is going to be very, very expensive. What is the status of coal when it comes to its cost, mining and extraction and processing?
There are a couple of different kinds of coal, which sometimes get confused in this discussion. There's metallurgical coal, which is used in the making of steel, and that's very pure, very high carbon coal that commands a high price, especially on the international markets. And that's not really the coal that's generally being talked about in a climate context. And it's a small proportion of the overall volume of coal that we produce. As far as thermal coal, so coal that's used to generate electricity, it really depends which market you're looking at. So the coal that's produced in Appalachia, you know, in the old kind of coal mining areas of the United States, the production costs are high because the coal is mined underground most of the time. It's relatively labor-intensive to produce. And it's close to population centers, so that can be okay. It's also very high heat content, so it's a relatively valuable resource. But the cost of extraction are higher, and many of the Appalachian producers have been actually seeing negative operating margins, i.e. they take a loss on every ton of coal that they produce, but because some of them are locked into long-term supply contracts with utilities, they're obligated to continue producing it. And we've seen recently, for instance, the bankruptcy of Patriot Coal, which was spun off really explicitly to go bankrupt because they could see that those operations were no longer going to be profitable in Appalachia. But then looking at the Powder River Basin, which is where about 40% of America's coal is produced, that's in Wyoming and Montana. And it's a gigantic surface strip mine. So instead of needing to dig tunnels and underground mining, it's really just a process of removing the dirt that's on top of the coal and then dragging a big bucket across it and, you know, dumping that into a truck and trucking it off to the train where it's delivered as far afield as Georgia in some cases. And for those distant deliveries, the transportation of the coal to the place where it's going to be burned actually ends up being a large proportion of the cost. And as oil prices have gone up, you know, all of these trains run on diesel, those transportation costs have increased. The production costs of the coal in the Powder River Basin have increased quite dramatically. As they dig further and further to the west, the coal beds dip downward. So they're having to remove ever more overburden, you know, the dirt that sits on top of the coal that is not coal. That material has to be removed before they can access the resource that they're trying to get at underground. And that's, you know, as you go deeper, that becomes more expensive. The ratio of earth that you need to remove before you can get to the coal gets higher and higher. So a lot of the coal producers in the Powder River Basin are now looking at the need to make fairly large capital investments to expand or continue their existing operations there. And they're hesitant to do so. They've been reluctant to make those capital investments to start up new mines. There were two auctions that failed last year in the Powder River Basin. The Bureau of Land Management, the federal government, owns most of the coal in the Powder River Basin, and companies apply to lease that resource and mine it. And there were two auctions at which basically nobody showed up. They decided it was not worth even very low prices that the USGS, or not the USGS, the BLM demands in those auctions to bid.
They've also been seeing
credit downgrades kind of across the board, with the exception of Cloud Peak. Cloud Peak is a relatively small and relatively export-minded coal producer in the Powder River Basin, but the other big three there are not doing very well.
Well, since we have a huge amount of coal in this country, unlike natural gas or oil, it won't be a lack of supply. Let's shift our final focus upon China. China has more of these coal power plants than anyone else I'm aware of in the world. And last year, from their own Academy of Sciences, they estimated over 1 million Chinese, mainly living in the north of China, died because of pollution from coal pollution. Now you can see with their use of coal and industries and oil, it's one of the most polluted cities in countries in the world, and some of their cities are in the top 20 most polluted. What do you see happening with coal or other energy shifting in China, and will they really put the energy into making cleaner alternatives? Are they willing simply to devalue life because they have so much life that they could get rid of? I don't say that in any callous way. I say it because I see how they calculate. Their calculus is extremely inhumane. Your thoughts?
Well, I actually, first I'd like to comment on what you said about supply in the U.S. And there is, you know, undoubtedly, there's an enormous reservoir of coal in the U.S., especially in the Powder River Basin, you know, many, many decades worth of coal. But it's a really important question to get at. Will it ever be mined? Can it be mined at a profit? So the fact that it's there underground does not necessarily mean that it's available for our use. And that's why investment has been hesitant to go into the Powder River Basin, because, you know, they see carbon regulations kind of coming down the pipe from the feds and internationally, and they see these large capital investments that they need to make that would not be paid back for decades, and it's just not clear that the market exists at prices that would allow that coal to be mined profitably. And this gets into work that we've done looking at the way the U.S. Energy Information Administration reports our reserves of things like coal. So reserves are stuff in the ground that you could mine at a profit. Resources is just stuff in the ground. And for many years, they've reported what are resources as if they were reserves without doing any kind of economic calculation to see whether it's likely that those things will be mined. And the USGS, several years ago, kind of called them on this with a National Coal Resource Assessment in 2009, where they looked at the economics of extracting these resources and decided it was actually very unlikely that a significant amount of it would ever be mined. On China, so, you know, their coal pollution problems, you know, that you talked about with their cities, those are very traditional air pollution problems, which, you know, Britain and the United States dealt with either, you know, around the turn of the 20th century or, you know, going through into the kind of Clean Air Act amendments that were enacted in the U.S. So they could deal with that in a way that didn't mean they don't have to rely on coal. They could continue to rely on coal. They could install the scrubbers that we've done in most of the developed world. But that really wouldn't do anything for the climate impacts of coal. So if we're really serious about, you know, not inundating several hundred million people's worth of city on coastal China alone, then coal, whether or not you remove those particulates and sulfur emissions, is really not going to be part of the picture.
Okay. I really appreciate your insights. For all of you, Kurt Cobb, Kevin Kamps, Dr. Zane Selvins, and Richard Heinberg, thank you all very much for sharing some very important insights on the current status of nuclear, coal, oil, and gas, something that we don't hear discussed in the United States unless generally by talking heads from institutes that are heavily funded by different foundations or individuals that represent those very interests. We try to do it objectively and honestly. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.